Okay, welcome back. This is Jeff Sachs from Web Yeshiva and Beit Knesset Mishkan Sipora in Efrat with Masechet Ta'anit. We are on Daf Yud Aleph Omud Aleph, towards the bottom. Let's find the right place and make it visible for everyone. Hold on, view, synchronize, let's get that little arrow going, okay. Omar Shmuel, here, Omar Shmuel, right below the arrow. Omar Shmuel, Kol HaYoshev B'Ta'anit Nikra Chote? That's a rather startling statement. Anybody who fasts is a sinner? What could that possibly mean? Savar, ki haitana, ditanya, because Shmuel sides with the opinion of the Tana who said, in the Braita, Rabbi Elazar hakapar barebi omer kol talmud lomar vechiper alav ma'asher chata al hanefesh. Vechi beze nefesh chata ze? What's this talking about? The Nazir. So the Nazir, we know, is this rather I don't know, what's the word? I don't want to say unique character. I know you can't say rather unique, but we do. The Nazir is somebody who takes upon all of these, what do they call, supererogatory restrictions and obligations upon himself in the name of holiness. He doesn't drink wine, he doesn't cut his hair, he refrains from becoming tamei under all circumstances. And when he finishes his period of Nazirut, Nazirut is a kind of vow. And a person can choose to be a Nazir, you know, for his whole life, or a person can choose to be a Nazir for a set period of time. When you finish your Nazirut, there's a whole process by which you exit the Nazirut, and you bring a Korban. Which kind of Korban do you bring? No?
A Shamar Chatat, I remember which one.
A Chatat. Right? In other words, the implication being that there was something wrong there. So the Braisa here says that fasting is not inherently good. As a matter of fact, there might be something sinful about fasting. Where would you learn such an idea? From the Nazir. The Nazir, who is quote-unquote fasting from wine, he's depriving his soul from the enjoyments of wine, and he has to bring a chatat. Kal v'chomer is someone who opts to fast and is depriving his body not just of wine but of food and drink and of everything. V'halo dvarim kal v'chomer. So the Gemara says this could all be learned from a kal v'chomer. Umaze shelotzir atzmo ela min hayayin nikrachote hamitzayir atzmo mikol davar vedavar alachat kama vekama. How much more so is someone who deprives himself of all the tasty pleasures of the world is a chote. This text here, or at least this position, we'll see it's soon countered by an alternate. This position is actually a pretty mainstream Jewish view. It's the opinion of the Rambam. The Rambam, in a lengthy passage in his Shmona Prakim, his kind of introduction to Pirkei Avot. You know, the Rambam's first major work was a commentary on the Mishnah. Interestingly, the Rambam, who lived about 1,000 years after the completion of the Mishnah by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, was the very first person to write a Mishnah commentary. The Gemara, of course, not being a commentary on the Mishnah in the way that we think of a commentary on the on the Mishnah. The Rambam wrote a commentary on the Mishnah, each and every Mishnah in Shas. And in a few different places in that commentary on the Mishnah, he wrote lengthy excursus, lengthy asides. The first is the introduction, the Hakdama LePerush HaMishnayot, which is a text very much worthy of our attention. It's a kind of introduction to the history and mechanics of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's an essay that stands on its own, independent of the fact that it's the introduction to the Mishnah commentary. Of course, there's a lengthy commentary at the beginning of Perek Chelek of Sanhedrin, where he discusses the Ikarei Emunah, the foundational articles of faith, from which we distill out the, you know, the animamins. The 13 animamins are a distillation of what the Rambam says there. And at the beginning of Pirkei Avot, he has a work called Shmona Prakim, because it contains, ready for this, 8 chapters. I guess it wasn't so original about coming up with names of the books. It's a kind of introduction to, well, I would say it's an introduction to psychology, anachronistic as that is. It's an introduction to the human personality development. In many ways, it prefaces his Hilchot Deot, which he would write much later in life. The Perush HaMishnayot was written when he was 30. He completed writing his commentary on the Mishnah when he was 30. Any of you under the age of 30, you still have a chance to finish writing your Mishnah commentary by the age the Rambam did. If 30 is in the rear view mirror, so then you really better get cracking. The Shmona Prokim is this kind of theory of personality development. And there's one chapter there which is dedicated almost exclusively, a large passage, to the topic of asceticism. This kind of idea that the religious person doesn't want to engage in the pleasures of the world, the pleasures of the appetite, the pleasures of the flesh, the pleasures of the world, of entertainment, of etc. The Rambam takes that idea to task. He really does not go in for that at all. And by and large, asceticism, you know, this kind of holding back from worldly pleasures, is never a mainstream Jewish idea. If you think of like certain Christian notions or medieval Christian notions, like vows of poverty and vows of of eating only water and bread and water. You these pictures of these monks or these nuns, cloistered away, who live a kind of subsistence existence just to stay alive, that this adds holy. This was never a mainstream Jewish idea. Here and there, in the history of Jewish life and culture, there were ascetic movements, but they were never mainstream. The Rambam's reflecting the mainstream Jewish position, and then, of course, once the Rambam articulates it, it becomes the Maimonidean worldview. Now, again, I've put in the asterisk, there were on the highways and byways of Jewish life, there were ascetic movements, but they were never mainstream. The Nazir, the Rambam brings, the idea of the Nazir as an example of Judaism's ambivalent attitude towards trying to find holiness through abstention. Now, to be clear, this is an idea which I feel that I've spoken about, that I've mentioned many times over the years in different contexts, but it bears a moment of repeating. To be clear, Judaism is not, what's the opposite of ascetic? David, help me out with your thesaurus.
Indulgent.
Indulgent. Right? Judaism is not indulgent. And you could argue that very much of the halachic agenda is to put up guardrails around indulgence. Last week we saw the pasuk "Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die," or you know the Hebrew equivalent of that idea. But the halachic project does not look at participating in the pleasures of the world as inherently sinful. Right? Think of like the stereotype, and it is, after all, only a stereotype. Think of the stereotype of the Christian, particularly the Catholic view, particularly about sexual relations. That it's the original sin, and that the ideal would actually to live a celibate life. But what can you do? Not everyone is cut out for that. But the idea that celibacy is somehow an ideal of holiness, albeit an ideal which only few can maintain, it still exists as an idea. That is a completely foreign idea to Judaism, right? But Judaism does say that sexual relations are something which are obviously tied up with very powerful drives, very powerful emotions. And there's the danger that those emotions can get carried away with themselves, that those drives can, if left unchecked, can get carried away with themselves. So the halacha sets up a path through which those passions and those drives and those appetites can be channeled toward holiness, toward sanctity. In other words, we achieve sanctity not by running away from those things, but by taming them, by harnessing them towards the life of sanctity. And that explains the halachot surrounding marital relations and Taharat HaMishpacha. The same is true, of course, with matters of the appetite. Judaism doesn't, quite the contrary. We think that it's okay to eat. We think it's okay to drink, right? The consumption of alcohol is not frowned upon, but is sanctified. Alcohol becomes one of the, pardon the expression, one of the sacraments, right? That we use wine to elevate the sanctity of Shabbat, right? However, the halacha also says, enjoy, b'tei avon, eat, but try to be healthy, and eat within reason. And we're going to create a system in which eating itself is an act of mitzvah observance. Think of sudot Shabbat, think of matzah, think of you name it. Homentashen. Well, it's certainly a minhag. But sudat purim, eating in the sukkah, these are not just halachically valid things, but they are mandated. However, we're going to say, you know what? There are certain things you can never eat. And there are certain things you can never eat together. And you know what? There are even certain days where you can't eat at all. In the Torah, at least on Yom Kippur. Right? And then Chazal expand that. But maybe we shouldn't go overboard. And perhaps that's the position of Shmuel here. Kol ha-yoshev b'ta'anit nikra chote. Clearly, Shmuel is not talking about somebody who's fasting on Yom Kippur, on Tisha B'Av, even on Tanit Esther. Now, you know, tomorrow's Wednesday. Thursday is Tanit Esther. That's a Tanit Sibur. This position that there's something inherently flawed about somebody who takes upon himself a fast does not apply to the Taniot Sibur, but somebody who is kind of looking to add on to the fasts. Now, you know, there are different customs. There are people that fast, you know, there are the kind of fasts that are on the calendar. Then there are the fasts that communities would declare upon themselves at times of trouble. And then there were people that were, you know, looking to add on fasts. There's this custom, this medieval custom of Bahab, of fasting, a cycle of Monday, Thursday, Monday, in cycles following the major Jewish holidays. There were customs that some had, not Hasidim, as much as misnagdim to fast on yahrzeits or on other days. There are certain people that fast. I once taught with someone who was a great faster, right? He once calculated, he told me that he fasts, again, and all these fasts being only half-day fasts from sunrise to sunset. I think he told me like he fasted like 80 days a year or something like that. I couldn't believe it until he did the math for me. Okay, there is such a tradition, minority though it be, but it seems to go against Shmuel's position that excessive fasting should not be taken on. But why should he be a chote? Why is someone who does this a sinner? Why is there some that think so? Some read the Gemara against everything that I've said until now. Who would take on a fast? Who would take on a fast that's not part of the regular calendar? Well, fasting is, after all, part of the tshuva mechanism. Tshuva, tfila, tztaka, ma'avirin et ha'roa ha'gzera, right? Tshuva is interpreted as involving fasting. That's part of what we do on Yom Kippur, after all. So some say no. You have to read the Gemara differently. Kol hayoshev b'tanit nikre chote. A person that's a chote should be yoshev ta'anit. That's if you've sinned, you should. You should fast. But that's not how most people read the Gemara, because it doesn't exactly fit in with the rest of the discussion about the Nazir, where there's clearly something being criticized. The Meiri points out that there are two different motivations for fasting. One is in order to do tshuva, or in order to fasting as a kind of impetus to tshuva. Right? The idea that, like, if you fast, you will be able to focus on your spiritual makeup, and you'll be able to concentrate on trying to get right with God and mitzvot, etc. And then there are other people that fast because fasting is seen somehow as a kind of way of being mosif kedusha. Right? You'll be like more holy the less you eat. So somebody who fasts in order to gain kapara for a particular chet, for a particular sin, so he's called a chote because that's what he is. That's the reason, because he's sinned. That's why he is fasting. But the fast itself does not inherently transform him into a tzaddik. Right? Now, the fast itself can't make a chote into a tzaddik. It can at best be a kind of trigger to tshuva. But somebody...
That's the message of the after on Yom Kippur, right? It says, I don't want your fast if you're not going to actually do tshuva with it.
Exactly. But the fasting itself is not tshuva. Fasting is something that creates an opportunity for tshuva. But somebody who takes on a fast in order to gain holiness, right? If he does it effectively, the Meiri says that might actually be a way to draw him closer to God. Others say, as David pointed out, the message of the Haftarah on Yom Kippur, who's called a chote? A person who fasts and thinks that, and confuses the means and the ends. Somebody who thinks that fasting itself is tshuva, that merely abstaining from food moves you from the position of being a sinner to being a saint. No, not at all. You're confusing the means and the end. You know, there are a lot of times, I mean, this is true for a lot, not for any of you, but it's true for a lot of people. You know, like a fast day, certainly these minor fast days, like Tanit Esther, Sarbatevet, whatever it is. You know, particularly you know, there's, when it's, if you live in a part of the world where it's a shorter fast, and, you know, Sarah Batavia, it's a good example. Sarah Batavia this year was Friday, right? Yes, it was Friday. So that's always a little unusual. And Tanit Esther, for those of us outside of Yerushalayim, it always kind of like leads into the Megillah. So like you're a little hungry for the Megillah. But like Asara Batevik, which is the shortest fast of the year in terms of hours in the Northern Hemisphere, the whole day can come and go. I mean, there are plenty of days. Asara Batevik, it's over by like here, by like 4:30 or something like that. 5 o'clock. I don't remember. There are plenty of days where I can go the whole day. I mean, I don't look like it, but there are plenty of days I can go the whole day without eating anyway for that amount of time. Right? If you skip lunch, well, usually I don't eat breakfast. Maybe I only have a cup of coffee. You know, if you skip lunch, you know, and have an early dinner, what's the difference? Right? So the very act of not eating for those, you know, what is it, you know, 10 hours does not ipso facto turn you into a tzaddik. So you know who the chote is? The chote is the person that misses this message. The person who thinks that merely not eating is itself atones for sins. Rabbi Elazar takes the opposite approach. If Shmuel said that a person who sins is a chote, Rabbi Elazar says that a person who A person who sins is a chote? No, I meant a person who fasts is a chote. If Shmuel says that a person who fasts is a chote, is a sinner, Rabbi Elazar says a person who fasts is a kadosh. He is a holy man. Hahu agidul perakai. No, so the Gemara says that who is the kadosh? The kadosh is not the faster. The kadosh is the nazir. Remember we said the nazir is the proof for Shmuel that a person who fasts is a sinner because he refrains from drinking. Kal v'chomer, somebody who refrains from drinking and eating. So Shmuel says, but wait a second, the nazir himself is called a holy person. Right? So how can he be a sinner and a holy person at the same time? So the Gemara says, no. In what way is he holy? He's holy because he doesn't cut his hair. Agidul se'ar. Al-Gidul Perakai. That is talking about letting his hair grow wild. Ula Rabbi Elazar ha-nikra chote. But Rabbi Elazar, so flip the question back on itself. Is the Nazir a kadosh? Or is he a chote? So Rabbi Elazar said that he's a chote. Because of the wine. So how could the Torah also call him a kadosh? The so'iv nafshe. The nazir is a complicated fellow. He's both kadosh, and he's also done something wrong. This act of letting his hair grow is an act of piety, an act of sanctity. But the fact that he causes himself to become impure, not that he causes, but if he becomes impure, he has sinned. So that is the so'ev nafshe, that he has impurified his soul, right? So in that way, he's a chote. A nazir can become a chote if he violates his nazirut. Umi amar, Rabbi Elazar hachi. So did Rabbi Elazar actually say this? Is that really what he's driving at? V'ha'omar Rabbi Elazar, le'olam yimod adam atzmo. A person should always measure himself. A person should always judge himself. Ki'ilu kadosh sharui betoch me'av. A person should always imagine that he's... Well, it's a machlokas exactly how to read this Gemara. But a person should always imagine, a person should always judge himself as if he has something holy within him. I mean, quite literally, in your kishkes, that you've swallowed something holy. Shne'emar, bekirbacha kadosh velo avo be'ir. There's a pasuk in Hosea that says the holy thing, the sacred thing, is within you. I cannot come into the city. It, meaning that pasuk seems to say that a person shouldn't take on fasting. In other words, you should have something inside your belly, that is kedusha. So there's a machlokas here between Rashi and Tosfot. Rashi says ki ilu kadosh sharui b'toch me'av, ki ilu kol me'av kadosh. Right, that all your whole your kishkas, your intestines, your inside, your innards are holy. Va'asur lahachishan, and you can't oppress. You know what's holy? It's like such a Jewish thing, right? You think about it. Like you remember those Snoopy cartoons. I remember there was in Peanuts there used to be this recurring comic. Snoopy would be out jogging. And the comic was his different body parts talking to himself. The head and the legs and the arms and the back and the whatever it is. This kind of dialogue of the different body parts, you know, and who's suffering the worst from exercising. Nobody remembers this? Really?
Too young.
But where is the seat? Like this idea that like the seat of reason is the brain and the seat of emotion is the heart. You know, in the medieval world and in the ancient world, this was not always the case, right? The seat of emotion were the kidneys, and the seat of reason was the heart. And you know, these things, these are all metaphors, of course. So where's the seat of holiness in Judaism? Like, what would you say? So you could say, well, the Misnagdim think the seat of holiness is the brain. And the Hasidim think the source of holiness is the heart. And that would be, that would be the classic argument between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, right? Right? Are we people of the mind or are we people of the heart? You know those stories about the Hasidim and the Misnagdim? You know, there's a story about the Beis Halevi, about Rabbi Soloveitchik's great grandfather, who once, like in an attempt to bring peace to the world, went to the Balatanya. I may be getting the story wrong. It was one of those icy, cold, snowy, wintry days in which the rivers were frozen over and the sun had not shone. And he goes to this tish, this chassidish, this misnagdish rov, this great Rosh Hashiva comes to the chassidish home, and the Rebbe starts singing a niggin, and the sun peeks through the clouds and melts the snow. And the flowers start blooming, you know, from between the piles of snow on the ground. And the world, you know, begins to break out of its cold. It begins to warm up. And this goes on for a little while, and you can tell the story as long as you want, you know, with the weather changing until the birds are tweeting. At a certain point, the Beis Halevi looks at his watch and says, "It's time to daven mincha." And the snow returns to the world. Did anybody watch Shtisel? Did anybody, you know, Shtisel just concluded? Has anybody been watching Shtisel? So, you know, it's like a joke about like the yeshiva guy. Like the yeshiva guy's out on a date. It's like a joke. It's like a story that could be in Halachic Men. The yeshiva guy is out on a date and they're looking out over the mountains and the sun is setting and it's beautiful and the rays and whatever, and the girl says, "Oh, that's a beautiful sunset." And the yeshiva bacha looks at his watch and says, "Technically sunset's not for another 6 minutes." Right? This is the difference between the heart and the mind. So according to the Gemara, where is the seat of holiness? It's not the heart. It's not the mind. It's the kishkes. The holiness is in the kishkes. You go to, remember Kiddush? Right? I feel my holiness has been deprived because I haven't had a lot of whiskey this year. I mean, except for Shalom, you sent us a little something 2 weeks ago, right? But think of all the whiskey we haven't drunk this year, all the herring we haven't drunk this year, eaten this year, because there hasn't been Kiddush. There's something holy in that. There's something holy in the eating. So the Gemara says that's, you know, you shouldn't be looking to fast extra. That's what Rashi's saying. Ki'ilu kol me'av kadosh. Your whole intestines are holy. V'asur lahachishan. And you shouldn't deny it. You shouldn't deny your intestines their due, their fill. Dahachi mashva bekir b'cha kadosh. Klomar da'asur lihitanot. You shouldn't fast beyond the fasts that are required by the Torah and Chazal. Tosfos says, Ki'ilu kadosh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the thing that's inside of you which is holy. Tosfos reads it differently. And it is the holiness that's in us, that's God himself. The spark of holiness within. But in all cases, you know, this pasuk is here to teach us that fasting isn't such something we should be running to do. Lo kasha ha de motzi letzuri nafshe, v'ha de lo motzi letzuri nafshe. So there's no contradiction here, right? On one hand, when we say that the person who fasts is kadosh, that's talking about when he matsui, the matsi letzaure nafshe. He's able to distress himself. In other words, where the fast is effective to be a real trigger to tshuva. But somebody who fasts, who merely goes without eating, and it doesn't serve as an impetus to tshuva. So that's a chote. That's all things being equal. You shouldn't afflict yourself. You shouldn't oppress yourself. We're not ascetic. Sometimes the Torah does demand you not eat. Right? So if you're fasting as a trigger, as an effective trigger to repentance, matovu manaim. But if not, so then you are liable for having afflicted, you know, having deprived your holy soul of its due.
Steinsaltz has a slightly different take on that. He says that it's when you can, let's say, you can stress yourself without causing bodily harm, and when you can do with, and it's not okay if you're going to cause bodily harm. Okay. That's the difference.
Okay.
I'm not, you know, I guess like the idea of like physical damage. I mean, obviously, if you're fasting and not doing anything and don't, you know, notice it, I imagine that isn't really considered a fast anyway, or at least, you know, wouldn't really accomplish the goal. But if it's not going to cause you to damage your health.
Okay, good. Reish Lakish, you see here, Reish Lamed, Reish Lakish Amar, Nikra Chosid. So here's a third idea. A person who fasts is not a sinner, and he's not inherently holy, but he's a Chosid. He's a righteous person. He's a pious person. How do you see that? Shnei Emar, Gomel Nafsho Ish Chesed, V'Oker She'ero, V'Gomer V'Oker She'ero, the Pasuk says, Achzari. A Chosid is Gomel. He pays his own nefesh, meaning he takes care of himself, right? He does the good things for his nefesh, but someone who is oker she'ero, someone who oppresses his own flesh, is achzari, is cruel, right? So in other words, that's you know, that resonates with that idea that David just said. Right, that is, if you're just doing it to hurt yourself, right, like some kind of eating disorder or something, so that's just plain cruelty. You're not allowed to be cruel to other people. You're also not allowed to be cruel to yourself. But if you're doing it in order to elevate your soul, so then that's something else. Amar of Sheshit, Hai Bar Beirav Diyotiv Betadita, Lechol kalba sheruta. He talks about a particular bar beirav, a particular yeshiva bocher, who's fasting. It's like the dog came and ate his food. In other words, you tell the teacher, "My dog ate it. My dog ate my homework." You know what a yeshiva bacher is supposed to do? He's supposed to eat lunch. Rabbi Bravender used to say that the definition of being in yeshiva is lunch. And lunch is like the most important thing in yeshiva. I mean, it's true because sometimes the most interesting conversations take place over lunch. But like lunch is like your ticket. You learn all day, you get lunch. Right? You feel like you feel that there's like reward in the world for your good activity. So like somebody who's like this yeshiva bacher who's fasting in the name of, you know, not properly motivated. So like it's no different than somebody who, you know, like the class bully used to come and like steal your lunch. The dog came and like grabbed your brown paper bag and ran off with it. So it's true, you didn't eat. Why didn't you eat? Because the dog ate your lunch. But that's not the same as fasting, right? Being hungry and fasting are two different things altogether. Omer of Yirmiya bar Abba, Ein ta'anit sibur b'bavil, elatisha ba'av bilvad. Well, that's really remarkable. Like, what does that mean? That there's no, they didn't have any fasts in Bavel except for Tisha B'Av. So first of all, clearly they had Yom Kippur. Clearly they had Yom Kippur. So which fasts are we talking about? So there are all different types of explanations for what this line means, that in Babylonia they didn't have these public fast days. Some say that we're talking about the fasts that our Masechta is dealing with. The public fasts that were declared on certain cycles aligned with the droughts. And in Bavel, there was no need for fasts around the droughts because they didn't suffer from droughts because they always had plenty of water from the Tigris and Euphrates to irrigate their crops. The lack of rainfall was not a sign that tshuva was required. That's what Tosfos here says. Others say that Jews in Bavel, by and large, suffered from poverty in ways that Jews in Eretz Yisrael didn't. And the Chachamim were not gozer ta'aniyot on poor people. On poor people who probably didn't have enough to eat at normal times, poor people who, if they had to miss work, would have been adversely affected. That's the opinion of the Ravid. The third possibility, that of the Ramban, said that this whole thing of declaring public ta'aniyot for certain events only applies in Eretz Yisrael, where you have a Sanhedrin, right? That regular Bate Din, you know, lower level Bate Din, could not institute such fasts. But the Gemara says that Rav Yirmiya bar Abba says that in Bavel they didn't have these extra fasts. Omar Rav Yirmiya bar Abba, Omar Resh Lakish, Ein Talmid Chacham Rashai Leshev B'Ta'anit. Mipnei Shemimma'et B'Malechet Shamayim. That a Talmid Chacham cannot fast or cannot accept upon himself additional fasts beyond those that the halacha requires, because the Talmid Chacham's job is to learn Torah. And you know that, like, the vision, I mean, this is anachronistic to read the Nefesh HaChaim back into the Gemara, but you know, the Nefesh HaChaim, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, had this idea influenced by Kabbalah that the whole world is only sustained through Torah study. And that if there would ever be a moment where Torah was not being studied, the whole world would revert to tohu vavohu, to nothingness and void that existed before creation. And in Volozhin, there were mishmarot, right? They had somebody was always on duty in the Beis Medrash, 24/7. Because without that constant ever-going voice of Torah, the world would collapse. I guess Volozhin, it didn't occur to them that, like, the Torah study in some other yeshiva, you know, could be doing the job. Like, if in Volozhin they all took 1 hour off, they didn't count the fact that there were other yeshivot elsewhere that could pull us through. They felt the responsibility on themselves, and they had this, you know, 24/7, you know, like there are certain places, you know, like the tomb of the unknown soldier. There's always that marine on guard 24/7. Outside Buckingham Palace, the guy with the bearskin hat is always there 24/7. And in the halls of Volozhin, in the halls of the yeshivot, there's always someone on duty studying Torah. Otherwise, the Torah will collapse. So since the Talmidei Chachamim have such an important job, and they're always on duty, and their job is Malechet Shamayim, is the work of heaven. So, like, we're not going to let them fast extra, because it's going. You know how it is when you fast, you can't. You just don't function as well. You don't function as well. I mean, Dr. Ben Zev, do you think like somebody could do surgery if they were fasting?
Short fast, maybe.
But like, would
but,
you,
you know,
would you
24 want, hours? No.
I mean, would you want somebody operating on you? You know, if it was the end of Yom Kippur or Tisha B'Av late in the afternoon, would you want that guy being the one putting you under the knife?
I would say no.
I mean, it affects your mental acuity. It affects your reflexes. It affects your. And I think we would say that Yom Kippur aside, someone who is in a essential service where his response time cannot be compromised, and it's a matter of potential life and death, we would tell them they should. If a physician finds himself on Tisha B'Av afternoon having to perform surgery, there's no other option, this is it, I think Poskim would tell him he should break his fast before he does that. He should have a glass of orange juice and something so that he'll be on the ball. I don't think that we would take that lightly and say it doesn't matter. So that's the Talmidei Chacham. Talmidei Chachamim shouldn't take on extra fasts, because by doing so they lessen the work of heaven. However, the Shulchan Aruch says that if it's a public fast, if the Chachamim instituted a fast because there's some tragedy that's befallen the community, you know, whether it's the drought or it's a war or something like that, so then the Talmidei Chachamim have to fast because they can't be Poresh Minat Sibur. Now that's the topic that we learned last week about somebody who doesn't fast when the community is fasting. The fasts that Talmidei Chachamim don't take on for themselves are individual fasts, right? Extra fasts. To go back to that topic of Poresh Minat Sibur, David, you made an interesting point to me this week in light of Inyan Ediyoma. So repeat that for us.
I mean, without getting into too much direct politics, but there was a whole story of the senator from Texas who
the gentleman from Texas.
Senator Ted Cruz left during the crisis in Texas, went to Mexico, and people were saying, oh, you know, what could he have done?
He went on vacation with his family.
And people were saying, oh, well, you know, people who were trying to defend him were saying, what could he have done? How could he have really helped? But the part of it was Poresh Minat Sibur. How it appears that Sibur to be not involved in it.
That's exactly it. It's an excellent demonstration of the problems of Poresh Minat Sibur. And here, particularly when you're a public official who's meant to represent people, you can't be, you can't separate yourself from the suffering of your constituents. Okay, we're going to stop there. We'll call it an early night. We'll continue next week from here on Yud Aleph Amud Beis. Okay.
Purim Sameach.
Purim Sameach to everyone.
Purim Sameach. Burns,
some